Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Belva Davis, journalist, host of KQED Television's This Week in Northern California, and your moderator this evening. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, David Weston, former president of ABC News and author of the new book, Exit Interview. David Weston is presently the president and CEO of NewsRight, and an ambitious venture to license original news content and collect royalties from aggregators. NewsRight was launched almost 6 months ago, and hopefully he will tell us a bit about it before the evening's over. He was president of ABC News for over a decade, from 1997 to 2010. During his tenure, ABC News received 11 Peabody's, 13 DuPonts, 4 Polk, and more than 40 news and documentary Emmys, plus more than 40 Edward R. Murrow Awards. Innovation was the hallmark of his administration. He created and built an array of special units for all ABC News outlets, led by Brian Ross's hard-hitting investigative unit. In 2007, he announced the largest single expansion of foreign news coverage in the history of ABC News by sending 7 new digital reporters to hotspots around the world. ABC also aired John Miller's interview with Osama bin Laden, the last with a Western journalist from Afghanistan, as well as Barbara Walters' interview with Monica Lewinsky, the highest-rated news program in television history. Before joining ABC, Mr. Weston was a partner at Wilmer Cutler & Pickering in Washington, D.C., where he was also a law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell, Jr. And oh yes, before I forget, he was president of ABC Network Groups for 3 years before heading the news division. So please give a warm welcome to David Weston.
Thank you, Melva. Thank you. Thank you very much, Melva. That was a gracious introduction. You can always tell a professional, can't you? Those dulcet tones and that voice. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here with you in San Francisco tonight. I've heard about the Commonwealth Club for years, and a good friend of mine, Nancy Gibbs, was just here recently with her co-author, Mike Duffy, for a President's Club. So she told me what a great experience it was, so I've been looking forward to being with you here tonight. I thought I would try to explain a little bit about why I wrote this book. I was fortunate in having a rather unusual experience. I started in journalism as the president of ABC News. I had not been a journalist before. And that meant that I had a very steep learning curve. I had a lot that I needed to learn. Frankly, looking back on it, I had more to learn than I realized when I started out. But it also gave me, I think, a sort of a fresh perspective, a perspective of somebody coming from the outside. And I was fortunate to be able to learn a great deal from some of the greatest journalists, I think, of their generation. And I wanted to share that experience with others who haven't had the opportunity to be behind the scenes in a newsroom, particularly when there are big breaking news stories. And it wasn't difficult for me to find some big stories to talk about, from the death of Princess Diana, which happened very early in my tenure, to the impeachment of President Clinton and the trial in the Senate, the tie election in 2000, the 9/11, of course, and then the wars that followed. So there were a number of major news events that we were called upon to cover during my tenure, and I got to see and work with the journalists as we struggled to do our best to do right by the American people in the way we covered those. Let me start, actually, with the death of Princess Diana. As I say, it happened early in my tenure. It was, if you recall, Labor Day of 1997. I'd been in the job about 4.5 months. And Peter Jennings was, of course, one of the people that I worked with. I got to know Peter very well. We became quite close personally and professionally over the course of my tenure there. But back in the fall of 97, he was a great journalist, and he, as a great journalist, was very skeptical of everything, including me. He was not at all sure why I was running ABC News as not being a journalist, and he wasn't very shy about it. And looking back, he was right. He was perfectly justified. We, as I said, worked on a number of major projects during our time together and agreed on almost everything. And when we didn't agree, Peter was right. But the first time we really clashed was over the death of Princess Diana. It was not comfortable. It was Labor Day weekend, as I say, so most people were away that weekend. And I find myself in the newsroom largely alone without people like Peter to talk to because they were out of town. And one of the first decisions I made was that we would prepare a primetime special to air the next night. This happened on a Saturday night, if you recall. We were going to air the special on Sunday. Peter called in about 11:20 at night when he caught up with the coverage. And I took the call actually on the newsroom floor just off camera from where our weekend anchor, Kevin Newman, was reporting about the death of Princess Diana. And Peter could be very firm and very to the point. He said, David, I understand Princess Diana's died and you're considering a primetime special. And I said, yes, that's right, Peter. We're working on it. And he said, well, that is your right. But I feel I owe it to you to tell you that if you do a primetime special on Princess Diana, no one will ever take you seriously as the president of ABC News. So here I am 4.5 months into my tenure, having come from outside journalism, and I have Peter Jennings, a bona fide legend, somebody I had enormous respect for, telling me I was blowing my first big news call and blowing it by a good margin. So I didn't have a lot of journalism to fall back on at that point. So I fell back on my family, and I said to him, Peter, I understand that she wasn't as head of state, but I have a sister back in Michigan. I'm from Michigan, by the way, but I have a sister back in Michigan, Rebecca. And Rebecca never reads tabloids, but she has read every detail about Diana's life since the moment she got engaged to Prince Charles. And I think there are other people who will feel that way. And he said, well, I said, it's your right. I will have nothing to do with it. And that was the end of the conversation. So here I am thinking, what have I done? I'm wrecking ABC News. Now, in fairness, Peter called the very next morning. I got a call at home, 9:30 in the morning. Said, David, I'm in the car on the way in. I've read all the coverage. You were right. I was wrong. And so I'd like to do the special. And I said, Peter, you are our principal anchor, so of course you can do the special. But I owe it to you to tell you that I've already signed up Diane Sawyer and Barbara Walters to anchor the special. So if you want to do the special, you will have to do it with the two of them as three anchors. And Peter, to his great credit, said, that's fine with me. And so what happened was we had a two-hour special that night, that Sunday night, anchored by Peter Jennings, Diane Sawyer, and Barbara Walters. Now, in that particular instance, which, as I say, was unusual, Peter actually was wrong and I was right, but that's not the point. That's not what I took away from this. What I took away from this was a much more important point. Peter was saying, you have to keep in mind the line between entertainment and news. You have to be thinking about why you're reporting this story. Are you reporting it because it's really of historical significance, or are you reporting it because people just want to know about it? And you have to keep that line in mind. There's nothing wrong with reporting things because people care about them, but you should always be thinking about exactly why you're doing it. That line, by the way, I think has moved substantially. I think if Princess Diana died today, there wouldn't be any debate in any newsroom about a primetime special. And probably it was right for the line to move. But what I did learn and I took away was the importance that there be a line and that people always be wrestling with that. There's no clear answer. It's not easy. And that was the point Peter was making. The most important story that I worked on during my time was, of course, 9/11. 9/11, as you recall, happened on a Tuesday morning. I was in my office. I tended to get in time to watch Good Morning America at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I sort of kept an eye on, I had, believe it or not, 9 monitors on my wall. And believe me, that will give you ADD if you didn't have it otherwise, is watching 9 television screens all day long. But I saw out of the corner of my eye, first actually it was on one of the cable news outlets, CNN, smoke coming out of one of the towers, because we were in commercial break. GMA was actually in commercial. Diane and Charlie were anchoring down at our Times Square studio. And then fairly quickly we came back out of commercial and we went to what we call a special report to the full network. And they started reporting there had been an incident. There were reports that a plane had crashed into one of the towers. And then not long afterwards, of course, we all remember we saw the second plane come across the screen live on TV. And it was clear we were under attack. And we came fairly quickly to the conclusion that it was probably terrorism and quite possibly Al-Qaeda. And that was because, as Melba already mentioned, In 97, my first year there, we aired that interview of John Miller with Osama bin Laden. He trekked through the mountains of Pakistan and had interviewed Osama bin Laden. And Osama bin Laden had predicted that they would be attacking civilians in the United States. Ironically, to think back on it, there was a big debate in our newsroom whether we would air that interview in 97, because most people didn't know Osama bin Laden, and some people thought he was really just something of a showboat, that he was looking for attention. And in the end, we did, of course, air it. So we jumped fairly quickly to the conclusion that this was likely terrorism and quite possibly al-Qaeda. It was obviously a horrendous story for all of us. It was horrific. It was tragic. It was wrenching. I did learn various things from our coverage of 9/11, which was not only that day, but we were actually on the air for about 100 hours straight, led principally by Peter Jennings, but with Diane and Charlie, as well as Ted in the evenings and Elizabeth Vargas overnight. One of the things I learned is how much we expect of all of our journalists at a time of crisis, something you may not have thought about, because everybody wants to reach out to their loved ones and be with them and console them and be consoled. And that's the time when, if you're a journalist, you absolutely have to be there 24/7 and working around the clock. A sort of ironic, even somewhat humorous story, believe it or not, out of that day came when our newsroom, late in the morning, started getting emails from an email account that we couldn't identify. And in fact, it was something, I may not get this quite right, but it was something like HotBabe364. And we kept getting these emails, or we couldn't figure out what this HotBabe364 was. It took us a half an hour or more before we realized it was George Stephanopoulos. George Stephanopoulos had gotten on the subway and worked his way down toward the World Trade Center and then walked down near Ground Zero and had struck up some sort of an acquaintanceship with a young woman and talked her into letting him use her computer. And so he was down there desperately trying to report in what he was seeing and what he was hearing. And it took us a half an hour or more to realize that, in fact, it was George Stephanopoulos. I also experienced fairly early on some of the pressures from the White House, because it was, of course, it was a terrible time for everyone. We didn't know what really was going on. We all felt under attack. We also felt vulnerable. And the White House took a fairly aggressive stance early on with our reporting. They objected particularly to Peter Jennings that first day, because Peter, among the coverage, I thought entirely appropriately, talked about the fact that we hadn't seen the president. He gave that first set of brief remarks down in Florida, if you remember, said he was headed back to Washington, but then they went on for security reasons. And Peter at the time said, presumably his security detail doesn't feel comfortable with it, but the White House was none too happy. And I ended up talking with them on the telephone, where they're telling me that they thought that we were being disloyal to even question where the president was at that time. Another issue that came up in 9/11. Actually came up the Saturday afterwards. We were on the air, as I say, for almost 100 hours straight. And at the end of it, we did a Peter Jennings special on Saturday morning for children. Peter, you may or may not recall, did several of these specials on very important, weighty topics where he tried to explain things to children and take their questions. And we decided to do one on 9/11. So we gathered a group of children with some experts together in a studio, and took their questions and tried to explain things. And in the course of that special, one of our experts, a man named Kyle Pruitt, a developmental expert, child expert, made a really telling point for me, which was, children don't process information the way the rest of us do. When children saw that video of the planes going into the towers and the towers coming down, they thought it was happening again. It was a new building. It was a different event. They didn't realize it was the same one. And by that time, this video had been shown hundreds of times across the cable networks and everything else. So on the car on the way home, actually, I called into our head of standards and said, we have a problem with this. I think we're really desensitizing people generally, but particularly we may be affecting children. So we adopted a policy right then that we would not show the moving video of the planes going in or the towers coming down on ABC News again. So from that day on, if we did things on the anniversary about 9/11, we would show still photos only. Because of our concern for how the children might be absorbing all this. One of the great perks of my job, and it was a great job, don't misunderstand me, it was really a great job, but one of the great perks was I got to fly around the world and talk to just about anybody I wanted. On the eve of the Iraq War, I went to the Middle East, and I had an extraordinary experience of sitting with Ariel Sharon in his residence one evening and talking about what was going on in the Middle East, and the next day going to Ramallah and visiting with Yasser Arafat, which was an experience because, if you recall, at this point, he was holed up in his bunker. It was this sort of largely damaged building, high-rise building, about six stories high or so, with burned-out hulks of cars outside it. And we went in, and he held forth, which was a great experience. I visited Latin America, got to visit with President Uribe of Colombia and Calderon of Mexico, and also Hugo Chavez, who is a very intense gentleman now since he's become ill, as you know, but I got to visit with him under a huge portrait of Simon Bolivar, whom he identifies with to a remarkable degree, I think it's fair to say. I got to travel with Barbara Walters to Cuba for her second interview with Fidel Castro. And that was a great experience, in part because I really was able to participate in, not only see the process that a terrific interviewer like Barbara goes through in doing an interview, the process by which she gathers together hundreds upon hundreds of questions, winnows them down. She and I flew down together, and we went over questions the entire time, so that she has thought about which ones to ask, which not to ask, which to combine, what order to put them in. There's a lot of thought and care that goes into a great interview that I think people otherwise might not appreciate. And that's what makes it look so natural when she sits down, because she has really done her homework so thoroughly. We did all this work on these questions. We're very proud of them. And then the way it works, I'm told, with Castro is that you go down and then you wait, because he doesn't particularly schedule a time to see you. You know, you have to wait, and they'll let you know when it's the right time to see him. So we were waiting 2 or 3 days, and at one point a group of officials came to have a drink with Barbara and me, and we were standing around with pleasantries. And in the middle of this, the senior most official said, and now we'd like to see your questions, please. And Barbara and I looked at each other across the room, appalled, because, you know, journalists don't give their interview subjects the questions in advance. That's not the way it works. And we said, I'm sorry, we don't give out questions. I was concerned, actually, that Castro might cancel the interview. But Barbara was much more confident, and it went ahead late one night. But in the course of it, we learned that there was another journalist from another network who was scheduled to fly in a couple of days later. And we were both concerned, Barbara and I were both concerned, that if this other journalist got the interview, they would air it first, and it would basically take away from what Barbara had done. So Barbara asked me to meet with the foreign minister to work things out. So I met with the foreign minister, and the foreign minister said, this makes perfect sense, that's right, absolutely, you should have the exclusive on this, but you have to talk to the president. That's above my pay grade. I can't make that decision. So I was basically assigned to meet with Fidel Castro to explain why in U.S. television it was really important to have an exclusive. So we went around to school the next day, Barbara with Castro and I was in tow, to talk to students about their experience. And I said at one point, you know, I need to speak with you, Mr. President. We have something we need to talk about. And he said, okay, fine, we'll get to it. And then finally we went off to a side room, this has been a terrific experience. I think this is a really good interview. I think you have a lot of things to say that people will want to hear. But in order for this to have the effect that you really want it to have, it's really important that it be an exclusive interview. And I apologize for raising this, but that's really the facts of life. And he listened to me, and to my delight, I don't know if it was surprise, but delight, he said, that's fine. Okay, it'll be exclusive. And we held our exclusive interview, which is a great experience. Diane Sawyer is someone that was a true privilege to work with closely for many years. Diane has a lot of remarkable traits. She has a versatility that is unprecedented. She can handle every sort of story. She's very smart. She writes beautifully. But I think one of the things that I respect most about Diane is she's totally fearless. And that fearlessness can express itself in going to Good Morning America, which she did at my request, and there was a lot more risk for her in that than there was upside at the time. When she first agreed to do it, she said, I'll do it for 3 months, David, on one condition, and that's that you pull me out if it's going badly. And I said, of course, Diane, I'll protect you. And then she was there for, I think, 11 years, as it turns out, doing a great job. But her fearlessness also expresses itself in a willingness to find stories that other people are not covering and going and covering them. Things like the underclass in America, in places like Camden, New Jersey, poverty, Appalachia, that she spent more than a year reporting on, Indian reservations. Sometimes the great journalists show their greatness in the stories no one else is covering. It's not the obvious story. It's the one that is not being paid attention to that should be. Now, we also had a fair amount of fun. And one of the things that was most fun was the millennium. The Millennium, I don't know if you recall or not, but ABC News, we put on a program for 24 hours. It's actually a little more than 24 hours, but 24 hours straight, where we essentially went around the world time zone by time zone as the clock ticked to 12:01. And when I first took that idea to Peter, Peter Jennings just loved it right from the outset, embraced it, and he said, but I want to anchor it. And I said, for 24 hours, you want to anchor it? And he said, absolutely, David. I want to do this. This is made for me. And it was in many respects because he was such a man of the world. He knew so much about the world. I'll tell you, about 3 days, I think, before the Millennium broadcast, just before we went into some rehearsals we did, I went down to visit Peter on a weekend in his office, and he was sitting there all by himself in his office with a stack of 3x5 index cards that must have been, I don't know, 12, 15 inches high. And I said, Peter, what are you doing? And as best I could figure, he was essentially trying to make sure he knew every fact about the world for 2,000 years, one after the other. And I said to him, Peter, you know, whatever happens with this, because it was a risk. We didn't know whether anyone would pay attention, whether it would be successful. I said, whatever happens, no one's going to come away from this experience having any doubt that you know a lot, that you know the world. So you can relax about that. That's not a problem. But it was a wonderful experience, and I treasure it. Now, actually, one of the biggest stories that we had during my time at ABC News was not one we covered. It was about us. And by us, I don't mean just ABC News, but about the news media overall. From 97 to 2010, which was my tenure, there was an enormous change in what the news media was in this country. If you think back on it, when I went to ABC News in 97, Fox News and MSNBC were about 2 or 3 months old. They essentially didn't exist. ABC News didn't have a website. We created abcnews.com my first year there. Much less what we've seen with search for news and social media and Twitter and all the rest of it. So what is described as news has expanded dramatically. It is an enormously bigger tent. When people talk about the news media now, it can cover a wide variety of things. It can cover everything from time-honored journalism, the way people like Peter Jennings and Diane Sawyer and Barbara Walters do it and did it, to blogs, to extreme opinion, to gossip, and it all comes under some big umbrella of news media. And I think a fundamental question is, does that change the nature of journalism? Does it really change the commitment, such as Peter had toward making sure you're covering something that's important? Does it change the drive to make sure you're getting the facts right, that you're checking and you're rechecking? Does it change the basic division between opinion on the one hand and fact-based journalism on the other? As I look around today, I see examples of both. Certainly we can find things that are examples of extreme opinion and of bloggers and of rumor and even innuendo and things. There's also some great journalism being done. Again, to come back to Peter one more time, he was one of the early adopters. He came to me in 2004 said, I really want to cover the 2004 conventions, gavel to gavel. And I know in this day and age, you're not going to do that on the network. You're not going to take the time to do that. But I've heard about this streaming video thing. And streaming video in 2004 was still a fairly new thing for most of us. And so we started something called ABC News Now with the Democratic Convention in the summer of 2004, where Peter Jennings anchored gavel-to-gavel coverage of the conventions on a streaming video that the internet made possible that otherwise wouldn't be possible. There are other terrific examples. George Stephanopoulos is a terrific reporter, a great journalist, and he really has embraced social media and the internet aggressively. On the other hand, there's a fair amount that all of us probably might cringe at a bit. On the internet. I do think that in the end, and this is really, I've discovered through the process why I wrote the book. As I say, when I set out, I wanted to write the book because I thought, I've gotten to see something I wish other people could get to see. Because it is richer, it is harder, it is in many ways more valiant than what I had appreciated great journalism really was. But as I've gone through the process, I realized that there's a further related reason why I really care about what I talk about in this book. And that is, I don't want this to be nostalgia. I don't want this to be left in the past and to say, wasn't that great we had Peter Jennings? Wasn't that great we had Ted Koppel? Wasn't that wonderful? They did great journalism back then. There are examples today of wonderful work being done. And I want to make sure that that quality of work continues well into the social media and whatever comes after social media age that we're encountering. I mean, there's a fundamental question about whether all these changes will make us better, more informed citizens, or whether it will reduce all the great work that being done to some lowest common denominator. And ultimately, this is one of the most important things, I think. Ultimately, it's not just up to the journalists, and it's not just up to the people who run news organizations. They have an important say in what gets done in journalism today. The public also has a very important say in what gets done. I learned at ABC News that even the very greatest journalists and even the best news organization do pay attention to what people are coming to. It's inevitable. If you care about what you're reporting, you care about how big your audience is. If you don't, you're keeping a diary. You're not really a journalist. By definition, if you really care about the importance of what you're saying, you want as many people to pay attention as you can possibly get. And what that means is, if everyone rushes to the latest salacious rumor or the latest celebrity scandal or something like that, there will be more of that coverage as a practical matter. On the other hand, if people seek out the really high-quality, great journalism being done, there'll be more of that, too. So you have a say. Everyone in the audience has a say and a responsibility, I think, in what journalism ultimately becomes. In the end, the biggest surprise for me today in journalism is not that there are things that make me cringe. Given how big that tent's become, it's inevitable. And it's probably healthy in some respect because there's more news and information than ever before. People are spending more of their time. And whether it's healthy or not, it's inevitable. That's the way it's going. But the biggest surprise isn't so much that there are things that make me cringe. The biggest surprise is that there is so much great work being done. In the early days of ABCnews.com, Charlie Gibson used to say, bemoan the fact, that when you looked at the top 10 stories in terms of traffic on the site, only 3 or 4 of them were what he would think of, or I would think of, as a substantive important news story. And I would always say to him, Charlie, the good news is with an unlimited number of choices, it's still 3 or 4 of the top 10. They can go to any bizarre video they want, and they're still coming to some very important stories, which is terrific. I'd like to believe that this will all continue. I'd like to believe that some of the time-honored journalism that people like Peter and Ted and Diane and Barbara have done will continue into the future. I think there's reason to believe that that is possible. As I say, there's a lot of great journalism being done by the old mainstream media as well as by new media. But ultimately, it will be up to all of us. And the thing I really want people to take away from this book is our joint responsibility to reward the great men and women who are working in journalism by giving them our time and attention. And thank you very much for listening.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. David Westin, former president of ABC News and author of the new book, Exit Interview. And now it's time for the audience questions, the fun part. We'll go back over some of the things you've already talked about and hopefully hear a little bit more in depth. And as you can see, we do have quite a number of questions, and most of them are not repetitious. They want to. And I thought the first one was interesting. Is there a particular event that has occurred since you left ABC News that you would have liked to have led the coverage on?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I have an immediate answer. There are 2 or 3 things, but the one time I've had any inkling of regret or saying, boy, I'd love to be there for that, was when they got Osama bin Laden. That was the one time when I heard that. And part of that was just to come full circle because I'd been with that story. And ABC News, we'd worked hard on reporting the al-Qaeda story and the Osama bin Laden story. And that was a story, yes, I would have loved to have been there to cover.
I imagine that's an affliction.
Yeah. Yes.
That will carry on with you when you've had the opportunities to be right at the forefront of some really big stories. In what way does the approach to reporting on ongoing events, how have they changed over time, such as is there a difference in the way we're covering the Iraqi war, or now, I guess, the Afghan war?
Well, the big change that happened during my tenure in Iraq was embeds. Embeds didn't exist before the 2003 war. So the other really big factor, I think, in news coverage, particularly television but not limited to television, is what technology makes possible. Because now, you know, anyone can have a camera just about anywhere, anytime. And you can also transmit out. I mean, going back to the Iraq War, we were still in the Stone Age in terms of telecom communication to get out by sat phone and things like that. Whereas today, I mean, it's advanced much beyond that. You can get fairly high quality streaming video just about anywhere. So that, I think that's changed coverage a great deal. I think overall for the better. The other thing, of course, another story that would be nice to cover was the Arab Spring. And the advent of social media and Twitter and some of the posting on Facebook and things like that, things we're seeing now in Syria. Now, it presents particular challenges, too. We had some of this during some of the demonstrations in Iran when I was there, how you vet that and make sure you're not being manipulated when it's not your people, it's not your camera person taking the video that you can check on, and you're getting it in over the transom. Presents certain challenges. But I think overall it's a good thing because we have access to more information and more video than ever before.
Well, that's a big debatable question, certainly with reporters who are out there and know the old ways. The inability to vet, to know, to affirm that what you're delivering are the actual facts. How much does that bother you?
Well, bother me. First of all, it's inevitable. Mm-hmm. So I try not to be bothered by things that are going to happen anyway. But what it does is it presents certain challenges and an increased responsibility on the editorial process. We certainly had this, for example, back in Iran when we were getting video. There are ways to check things to figure out, you know, is it possible that that happened and were those people in that place and what else do you know about this source? That are not different in kind from what reporters have always done. We've always had sources of some sort or the other, and it's always been a challenge. And also, it makes us nervous to some extent because you know, no matter how well you've vetted the sources, you could be wrong. Somebody could be misleading you. And it's happened in some notorious examples. So I think it increases the responsibility on the editorial process. But again, I think, in general, more information is something we shouldn't resist as journalists. It's just a question of what we do with it, how we process it, how we vet it. And we do have a responsibility to make sure it's right.
You volunteered to take over as president of ABC News. It was a step down for you, according to this writer. Then you had to wait 15 months for Roon to retire. Can you explain why you volunteered?
Yeah, this is an exit interview. I talk about this in the beginning. Step down. In the organizational chart, it was a step down because I was head of the network and news reported to the head of the network. It was not a step down, certainly looking back on it now, but I don't think I felt it was at the time because ABC News is and was a very special organization. And being able to run that day-to-day has a lot of challenges but a lot of rewards attached to it. So I never felt that it was really a step down, but it was, that's right, in the organizational chart. And I took it for, I think good and sufficient reason, but not the reasons you'd like to hear. I had not had a lifelong quest to run a major news organization. I had been a lawyer, as you said, in Washington, and then I'd been a general counsel of Capital Cities, ABC, the parent company. I had worked with the journalists at ABC News as their lawyer and then as the supervisor of the network. But it wasn't something I was questing for. It was a matter of my predecessor, Roon Arledge, who was a legend, first in sports and then in news, coming toward the end of his tenure and our needing to find a successor. And I tried to do that as the head of the network, working with my boss, Bob Iger, who now runs the Walt Disney Company. And we tried for several months. It was a pressing issue for us because we cared about ABC News and we wanted to make sure that it was able to make the changes that we knew were going to have to be made. And I kind of pulled a Dick Cheney, in a sense, in the sense that I tried several things. None of them worked. And in the end, I reluctantly said to Bob, I think I could do that job, but I'm not sure I want to. And Bob said, I think you could do it, but I'm not sure I want you to either. And then we talked about it for a while, ultimately concluded we would do it. So I did it really more as a good corporate citizen, but also somebody who cared about ABC News, and I thought I would be a transitional figure, really. I thought I would go and do that for 2 or 3 years until someone else came along. And the surprise to me, the thing I did not predict, is I loved it. I've been blessed with a number of really great jobs, working with some great people. There's nothing like running ABC News. It was a fabulous job, but I didn't know it when I took the job. I just blundered into it. I got lucky.
Will investigative journalism continue to play as much of a role in the field of journalism as it has in the past?
I hope so, and I believe so. You mentioned in the introduction the investigative unit we put together at ABC News when I was there with Brian Ross and others. And we invested in that at a time when there was a lot of pressure on resources. We put more resources into it, partly because I believe in it. I think it's one of the, not the only, but one of the principal responsibilities of journalism is to hold people accountable. To find out things that people in power, whether government or otherwise, people in power would rather you not know, I think is right at the core of what great journalism is. But I also think that it can be justified as a business matter, because if you think about it, in a world where there's more and more outlets, who many of whom are telling you different versions of the same thing, an exclusive investigative report is something that you really own. You can rise above the crowd and get attention, and you can draw an audience to. And I also saw that, I believed, in the Internet, as we went to the Internet. If we had a significant investigative report, our traffic would spike immediately. It would go up. So the good news is I think this is one time you can do well by doing good when it comes to investigation. So I actually am hopeful for investigative work, but let's be clear. It costs money. This is one of the things I do talk about in the book is the business of journalism is right next to the journalism. If you don't care about the business side of it, you don't care about the journalism, because really good journalism requires investment of money. And I always took that very seriously, that I needed to manage the business side so we could do the journalism, because I cared so much about the journalism.
Well, scattered throughout, there'll probably be other questions that bear on the same topic. What is your view of the blatant right-wing reporting of Fox News? Is there any objective reporting done anymore? Without completely blurring the line between news reporting and editorial comment.
Well, you've hit on a sore spot for me. As I said in my remarks, one of the big changes was the advent of cable news, and particularly Fox News and somewhat later MSNBC, which changed the environment. I mean, again, to just go back and think what our mindset was and how wrong we were, when Fox News and MSNBC were first announced, we thought, why does the world need three 24-hour breaking news channels? Why is there room for three of them? We really missed the fact that what Fox News was doing was something different. It was mixing polemics with news, and it was a very powerful combination. And it's a brilliant business model. Understand this, it's a brilliant business model. And MSNBC now, to some extent, appears to be taking a chapter out of their book. And the reason it's brilliant is because when you're supported by advertising, then what matters is getting as big and broad an audience as you can. Because anybody you lose out of your audience makes you lose money because you don't get as high ratings and you don't get advertising. When you go over to the cable area, cable is supported every bit as much by subscription fees as it is by advertising. And so when you go to subscription fees, passion counts more than the size of the audience. You can make more money by having a smaller audience that is passionate, because if you have 10% of the audience or 15% of the audience who says to their cable provider, I will turn off my cable box if you don't have that channel on, then you can command an enormous rate out of the cable, a cable operator. It's a good, really smart business move. Now, you see it in other parts of cable. It's not just It's not just news. I mean, you can see that HBO, to some extent, is a matter of passion, deep engagement. It's not as relevant how many people, but people who care about it have to have their HBO. Disney Channel, in a different way, has deep engagement, and it's very successful. When you go over into news, what engagement has turned into, I don't know that it has to, but it has, is partisanship. And so you have right and you have left. And that in itself, I mean, is not necessarily evil. We've always had opinion in newspapers. There's an editorial page, there's an op-ed page. What is the problem, and that's what it's identified in the question, is the blurring of the line. It's when you mix the front page with the op-ed page that I think that's dangerous. I think journalists owe people more than that. They owe it to you to tell you, now I'm telling you this because I believe it to be true, as opposed to I'm telling you this because I want it to be true, or even worse, potentially, I'm telling you this because I think you want it to be true. I figured out what you want, and so I'm going to try to give you that. That is really a danger, mainly for society. I think our republic is weaker. We're not going to solve our problems if we just are picking up sides and making up our own facts. It's that Moynihan quote, everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but nobody's entitled to their own facts.
What if anything can be done about it? In fact, the question here is, can you name 5 TV news anchors who do not violate that line?
Oh, what I can do is I can name 5 television news anchors who care about the line and who struggle mightily not to violate it. The fact is, we're all biased. Everybody's biased. I mean, in the book I talk about this. I come from Michigan, as I said. I went to the University of Michigan, you know, when we had Bo Schembechler as our coach. If I covered a Michigan football game against Ohio State, I would be biased. I might struggle really hard not to be biased, but I would have a tough time doing that as a practical matter. The question is not whether we're biased. The question is, are we going to fight against it, or do we just give into it? And I think there's a big difference between those two, because the fact that everyone's biased doesn't mean that you can't struggle to be less biased, as opposed to just embracing it and saying, that's fine, I'm biased and I'll go with it. And so absolutely, I mean, George Stephanopoulos works really hard not to be biased. Absolutely. Jake Tapper, but Brian Williams understands this. Diane Sawyer understands this. Now, you can think maybe they succeed or they fail, but it's really valuable that they're trying. And what I really want people to realize is not all news is created equal. There is a difference. There is a difference, and I saw it in my experience with the struggle behind the scenes to try to do the right thing.
How much do you think the absence of a strong federal role, the FCC and regulatory, and I don't mean in the telling you what to say and what to do, but just with various regulations to sort of keep things organized, with the disappearance of that hand that was there for so many years?
Well, it's changed the nature of broadcasting. I mean, the FCC and the federal government has never regulated cable the way they did broadcasting. On the theory, going back into the 50s and even before that with the Radio Act, that they're public airwaves. And so you're holding something in public trust and you have obligations. My own understanding of history is that in the early days of television, the Bill Paleys of this world and the General Sarnoffs essentially, not explicitly, but effectively made a deal with the government. And they said, if you let us run I Love Lucy or make a lot of money off of entertainment programming, then we will build a really good news organization. And so I personally think it's a mistake to think that there were these wonderful people who just decided out of the goodness of their heart they were going to invest a lot in news. I'm not sure that that ever really happened. It was a good, solid business decision made. But it was informed by the federal regulation that you talk about. With deregulation, that went away. And so the rationale for news had to shift. It came also, frankly, at a time when broadcasting was expanding dramatically. 60 Minutes came on the scene and went into prime time, which is a wonderful program to this day. They've done a fabulous job with it. They've also made a lot of money off of it. And so, again, it's a mixed decision. News had to start justifying itself by return to shareholders, as well as reflecting well on the company and, you know, being good for the brand. And that's the reality we have today. But I do think that the change in federal regulation had an effect. Now, you can argue whether that's good or bad, because, in fact, the federal regulation did get into, I think, some substantive speech regulation and some issues. And there were some some issues about that. But the fact is, it's different. There's no question about it.
And thinking of elections and the old equal time rules.
Exactly. Fairness doctrine, equal time.
Right. Those missing elements now? Or is the business doing better? Is journalism better with them gone?
You know, I think that those were valuable things, although broadcasters certainly resisted at the time. They were valuable things at a time when you had three networks. This has exploded so much now. You can find anything. That's why... Part of my point is we all have to be our own editors now. You know, it used to be the fact that there were a few trusted editors nationally, whether it was print or broadcast. That's not true anymore. Everything is out there. And so all of us as citizens have a responsibility to be more discerning, to be more thoughtful about what we're watching. And I mean, one of my pet peeves are people who complain about the latest celebrity scandal and all the coverage of it, and then recite to me every single detail about it. So it's pretty clear they're spending a lot of time paying attention to it. And I want to say, well, just don't watch it. You know, if you don't watch it, they won't do as much of it. But I do think we all bear a certain responsibility.
Well, from your experience in the 2000 election and the national election since, how is the nature of political coverage in particular changing due to innovations such as the internet and social media, and we can expand on that, and some of your thoughts about both of those things?
Well, there are at least two, I think, fundamental changes. The news cycle has turned from 24 hours into nanoseconds. I mean, the time to respond and react and think, I mean, it's constant. And you can think that that's a good thing because we all have more news, but also things get misreported or just spurious reports get out there, and they go around and sometimes get picked up even by some mainstream media before they can get denied, which is a real problem. It's a real danger because people form impressions. They'll hear something and it sticks in the back of their mind and they still think it's true, even though it's been totally disproved. So that's one issue. The other issue, and this is on a continuum that I saw, because in the early days of my tenure, we already had presidential candidates, for example, moving away to some extent from news outlets and starting to do late-night talk shows and daytime talk shows and MTV and things like that. So you didn't have to go to the Peter Jennings or the Ted Koppels or the Barbara Walters for interviews. You can go anywhere. That has now exploded in social media so that political candidates go directly to their people. It's all done on Twitter, and it's all done on Facebook, and it's all immediate. And so the role is a more challenging one, I think, for some of the more mainstream traditional news organizations. They have to be the curators of that. They have to go after it and correct mistakes and really put it in context after the fact. They're not gatekeepers anymore. They're people who come along and vet often after the fact and cover what has been said and that it's wrong.
Well, I want to remind our audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program, and our guest is David Weston, former president of ABC News, who's discussing the inner workings of broadcast journalism. And we will continue with more of our audience questions. And you certainly have sparked... This is a card that says... Person sitting here in the room with you that says, I was in Paris, France, when 9/11 occurred. We watched British, French, and Italian media because American reporting was so far behind with information. Why?
It's the first time I've heard that. I mean, I was in New York, so I didn't see the other. Well, it certainly wasn't intentional. We weren't holding anything back. And it's interesting. My perspective is quite different on that, having been in the control room and with Peter on the floor and things. Our challenge was we were getting information in so quickly that we couldn't vet. And what really happened, one of the things, just having been in the newsroom, the feeling was, I mean, to cast our mind back there, it was so unthinkable what had happened. I mean, that first there were planes flown into the two towers, and then a plane was flown into the Pentagon, and if you recall, when the first tower came down, Peter Jennings on the air couldn't believe it at first. He kept reporting, he kept correcting our reporter who was on the scene, saying, "You mean a piece of the building fell off?" He said, "No, the building came down." He said, no, but aside, some part of it. Peter literally couldn't believe it. None of us could. It was unimaginable what was going on. But on top of that, we now know, looking back, exactly pretty much what happened. You know, the two towers came down, the attack on the Pentagon, the plane in Pennsylvania. But at the time, there were reports that there were all sorts of other planes, and there were all sorts of other buildings under attack. And there were bizarre reports that normally in another world you would have just dismissed, but given what had happened, you couldn't rule anything out. And so we were frantically trying to vet these things. And at the time, and I do not blame the government for this, we were not getting anything out of the government. The federal government had shut down. Vice President Cheney had gone to a secure location in a bunker. President Bush was on Air Force One. And again, they were doing that because they were worried about the security of the country. But it left us by ourselves out there trying to vet these things and figure out what was going on and report as best we can. So I'm not exactly sure what information was reported first in England and France. That's the first I'd heard of. But the one thing I can promise you is we were not holding back anything because we thought we should. By the way, not on 9/11 itself, but in the two or three or four days after that, there were requests from the White House to hold back on certain reporting. That they thought was, I'm sure, in good faith, necessary for national security, that we pushed back on and said, we don't think that's a good idea. We don't. If the nation ever had the sense that the government was agreeing with the media to hold things back, then the media is not going to be able to trust anybody. And so we're not going to be able to do that.
Well, I want you to read the book, but I got to tell you, that's one of the exciting chapters in our own Condi Rice's role in executing the wishes of the White House on that. So you seemed emotionally involved in the debate about what you should do, and it was putting your patriotism against your news judgment, I guess, be the way. And you had something in the book that you talk about whether to wear a lapel pin or not.
Yeah, that is in the 9/11 chapter. It was a couple of days after 9/11 itself, while, again, we were still on the air nonstop. And I was in the control room at the time, and I had our head of communications come up to me, the fellow who dealt with the press and things, who said, we're getting press calls asking why your people on the air aren't wearing American flags on their lapels, because some of the cable people had gone to wearing lapel pins. By the way, they ended up with American flags in the backdrop and in the bumpers and the promos, and it was just all over the place. I thought about it for a minute. We had had a policy at ABC News long before I was there that no one wore any kind of lapel pin on the air. And the rationale was, when you're reporting the news, you should be reporting the news because you believe it to be true. You shouldn't have any perceived allegiance to any particular cause or organization. And at the time, and this is true to this day, all of the members of the administration always had a lapel pin on. Always, whenever they appeared, they always had a lapel pin on. And what I thought was two things. One is, if we start wearing lapel pins, are people going to think, okay, they're sort of identified with the administration and they're telling me things because that's the administration's point of view? And it occurred to me, even at that point, and it's a time when we all, I think, felt intensely patriotic because we'd all been attacked and we'd have thousands of our innocent fellow civilians killed. But I thought, you know, sooner or later, there's going to have to be some parting of the ways here. We're going to have to report on the administration in a way that distances ourselves. And I don't want people getting confused. I don't understand why is he wearing a lapel pin and he's wearing a lapel pin. The other thing, I'll be perfectly honest, it flashed through my mind, because these sorts of things come up and you don't have a lot of time to think about it. You know, you need a response. And I thought, well, we do have our principal anchor who's Canadian. And what's going to happen when I go to Peter and say, Peter, you have to wear an American lapel pin? Now, Peter subsequently became an American citizen and was intensely patriotic, but at the time, he was not. And that made me think, well, okay, we're going to start differentiating people in the air, whether they wear a lapel pin or not. I mean, our patriotism should be caught up in something more than whether we have a lapel pin. So I said, no, we're sticking with the policy. And it was very controversial, and I came under a fair amount of personal criticism for that position. But by the way, I respect people on the other side of it. I would make the same decision today. I think it was the right decision.
You were, at least in my reading of other stories I read about people in your position, and really activist. You're right there in the control room. You're involved. You were there as many hours as many of the people who were working for you. Talk a little bit about that part of your management style.
Well, I mean, I don't think of myself as a micromanager. At the same time, particularly when it's breaking news, you have to be there. You have to be in the process for several reasons. One reason is that you don't want to expose your people all by themselves. You need to be in a position to back them up and say, we talked about this, I agree with that decision. And that's to the outside world. It's to the corporation, you know, to any number of people. And if you're not involved in the process and making the decision and in a position to back them up, then you're really not doing your job correctly. Also, a news organization like that, particularly in breaking news, you can go wrong. It's very exciting. Let me just make this clear. Being in a live control room when it's breaking news is very exciting. So I don't want to act like it's some big burden. But part of the excitement is you can go wrong in an instant. You know, you are called upon to make certain judgments. Do we go with the story? Do we not go with the story? And if you get it wrong, it can be pretty bad. And if you have something like Peter Jennings, who is so great at breaking news, I mean, he was a fabulous journalist, really great. But if you think about it, he's on the air. You can't say, okay, let's take time out now. We're going to take 5 minutes and just go off to the side here and have a conversation about this. So I would be I'd go down on the set and sort of talk to Peter off to the side and say, you know, this is what I'm doing. What do you think about this? What do you react to that? So you had to be there to participate in that process. You couldn't do that from a remote distance. And as I say, it wouldn't be fair to Peter or the producer in the control room or anything else to say, you just make your own call, and then if it goes wrong, you know, then it'll be on your head. I mean, I had to be in a position to say, no, I was there and I decided that.
Well, you write about some close calls and some that you thought over and wondered whether you made the right decision.
Some I got wrong.
Yeah. Do you mind even sharing one little short story as we...
Well, sure, 2000 election. 2000 election. I mean, think about it. We got that election wrong twice in one night. You know, we projected it for Vice President Gore relatively early in the evening in Florida, and then we had to pull it down after a couple of hours. And then at 2:30 in the morning, we projected it for then-Governor Bush, and then had to pull it down after a couple of hours. And the fact is, in retrospect, it was a tie election. You couldn't project anything that night. You know, the margin of error was greater than the margin of the difference in the votes. And I particularly regretted it because we were last. I mean, on the second call at 2:30 in the morning, everybody else, all the other networks, cable and broadcast, had all projected it for Bush. And we could have just held back. And I was in the control room. And they asked me, do you want to overrule and go for Bush? I said, no, we'll go with the decision desk. And then our decision desk said, yes, it's okay. And we went through it. And I, you know, I could have been not a hero, but in a lot better position than I was testifying before Congress about how we could have gotten something that important, that wrong, twice in one night.
You've encouraged people several times tonight, you know, to watch, look, and listen. But with the new rules around expenditure of funds and the abundance of commercial messages, is there a chance they could overshadow the news versions of event by running just volumes of these one-sided, because that's what they're supposed to be, they're paying for it, you know, messages?
Well, it certainly looks like they're trying, right? I mean, it looks like they're trying to overcome the news organizations. Listen, money in politics is a much bigger topic, and I think it's something that all of us be concerned about, and I was concerned about. We tend to cover politics as sort of partisanship right and left, and I don't think we spend as much time as we should on just money. Follow the money, the way they said in Watergate, and it can explain a lot of what goes on. But all I can say is it's up to the news organizations to do their best to counteract that. When there are things being said that are wrong in political commercials, advertising, to call it out, to report it, to shine a light on it. But ultimately, this has been true for the entire history of the country. We have to trust the people. We have to trust the people ultimately in the long term to be discerning and to be smart enough and to be skeptical enough, the way Peter was skeptical, to discern the truth and make the best decisions.
Yeah. I was just wondering, have we crossed some lines that the formula that we once knew cannot be as reliably counted on by good news organizations to get ahead? I mean, so much social media, so much Twitter, so many commercials, so many ways to receive both good and bad information?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to the question, of course. Mm-hmm. I will say I think there have been a number of times in the history of the country where people thought, you know, it was all going south, and somehow the country's always come back and been resilient. I think the system, and the First Amendment's right at the core of that, has worked awfully well for this country for a long time. So I don't know the answer, but I wouldn't bet against the system, even with the stresses and strains of everything from social media to these PACs that have so many millions of dollars to invest in negative advertisement.
Right. At what point in your time at ABC News did you find your background in law was more appropriate than the field of journalism in addressing the challenges facing news today?
Well, there were, of course, legal issues that came up that I knew something about and was pretty comfortable with. And that could be everything from the Ken Starr investigation and the grand jury investigation to the Bush versus Gore decision in the Supreme Court. I mean, when it went up, if you recall, it went up the Supreme Court once and came back down and went up a second time. And I could speak with some confidence about, in general, the way the Supreme Court worked. By the way, not with confidence about how they would come out, but how they worked in general. So that was helpful. But the broader point that I felt from my time was that journalism and law, I think, intersect in one very important way. Or maybe I should say journalists and lawyers do. The hallmark of a really good lawyer is knowing what questions to ask. It's not having the answers. It's knowing what questions to ask. My experience with journalists is the best journalists were the ones that knew which questions to ask and how many questions to ask and who to trust and who not to trust. And that intersected, that overlapped quite a bit with my experience with what a really good lawyer does.
Mm-hmm. Well, what type of discussion would you have today with your team in deciding how to cover critical issues today where it's so quick to get information into their hands that may not be? Have you thought it through? Could you do it any different from what you've always done?
You know, I think basically it's the same in this respect. The question is, how much of the truth can you learn about something that matters? That's what the core question is. And that's true whether it's happening quickly or slowly. And you have to resist the temptation to go quickly in order to do that. And the second thing is always be willing to correct yourself. I think sometimes journalists are a little too reluctant to go back and say, you know what, I reported that because I believed it was true. It turns out it wasn't exactly what I thought it was, or maybe it's even contrary to what I thought it was. But I think the basic quest for truth is the same, whether it's social media or whether it's more traditional media.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the point of the program where there's only time for just one more question. So could you explain your new role at Newsrite? How will it interact with the Huffington Post, say?
What we're doing is representing a number of newspapers in the Associated Press in developing a business model to sustain original journalism in the digital age. That's the mission. And the basic idea is, there's huge growth, actually, in news, but almost all of it's on the Internet and mobile. And much of the information being consumed ultimately comes from newspapers, but it's not on newspaper sites. It's on third-party sites who take the information from the newspapers. The question is, can we develop reasonable licensing ways so that we can still afford the reporters that I think we all need in this country?
All right. Well, our thanks to you, David Weston, former president of ABC News and author of the new book, Exit Interview. We also want to thank our audience here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. We also want to remind everyone here that copies of Mr. Weston's new book, Exit Interview, are on sale in the lobby, and he will be pleased to sign them outside the room immediately following the program. I'm Belva Davis, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you, Melba.
Thanks a lot. That's fun.